Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something really critical, an area where sharp nursing skills truly make a life or death difference.
That's right.
We're talking about airway oncology, specifically laryngeal and lung cancers.
Yeah.
And this isn't just theory. This is for you, the learner, the nursing student. Think of this as a high-yield review for exams, sure, but honestly, more for what you'll face in practice.
Exactly right. Our goal here is to cut through, you know, all the complex stuff you get in lectures. We want to boil it down to the essentials.
That really matters.
What really matters for assessment, for intervention, we're laser focused on the ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation, always the priority in oncology, especially here.
Right.
So we've synthesized material on the epidemiology, risk factors, how these cancers present, treatment options, surgery, chemo, radiation, immunotherapy, and importantly, those hands-on nursing skills.
Like track management.
Oh, yeah. Track management, communication rehab after surgery.
Yeah.
Key stuff. By the end, you should really feel confident about the actions needed to keep these patients safe.
Okay, let's unpack this then. We've got two cancers here.
Sure.
Related, but distinct.
Mm-hmm.
Lung cancer. Well, that's the big one globally, isn't it? Drives those mortality stats way up.
It really does.
And then laryngeal cancer, which maybe it gives clear warnings sometimes, but still needs super quick action if it's advanced.
That's a good way to put it. Let's anchor this with lung cancer first. The epidemiology is, well, it's stark.
Yeah.
It's still the number one cause of cancer death for both men and women in the U.S. The numbers are huge, over 135,000 deaths in a recent year, something like 228,000 new cases.
Wow.
But here's the kicker for nursing, for why we push screening. The prognosis is often poor because it's caught late. Nearly half of patients already have spread regional or distant when they're diagnosed. Almost half. And that leads to a five-year survival rate overall of just 21.7%. It's chilling.
21%. That really drives home the need for early detection.
Absolutely paramount. Not just important, paramount.
And the why behind it seems so direct. The cause is overwhelmingly linked back to things people inhale, right?
Exactly. Inhaled carcinogens. Primarily cigarette smoke. We're talking 85 to 90% of cases.
85 to 90.
Huge. It's basically chronic, repeated DNA damage to those epithelial cells lining the airways. Often starts where there's been previous lung injury or scarring, too.
Which brings us straight to a core assessment tool. Every nurse needs this.
Yes. You absolutely have to understand and use PACEARS.
Yeah.
This isn't just, you know, a random calculation. It's the standard way we quantify smoking history.
How do you calculate it?
Simple formula. Number of packs smoked per day multiplied by the total number of years the person smoked.
Okay, packs per day times years.
And why it's critical knowing that PACEAR history tells you who's eligible for screening, who needs really aggressive help to quit. The risk isn't just about the total number, it's the cumulative exposure over time. More exposure, likely more DNA damage.
Makes sense. So if the cause is inhaled stuff, the treatment must depend on the exact type of cancer cell involved.
Precisely. You've got to know the two main classifications. They're treated very differently.
Right.
First, the most common one by far is non-small cell lung cancer, NSCLC. That's about 84% of all lung cancers.
84%.
Yeah. Within NSCLC, there are subtypes, like adenocarcinoma, that's actually the most common type now, often found out in the periphery of the lungs. And then there's squamous cell carcinoma, which tends to show up more centrally near the bigger airways, the bronchi.
And how's NSCLC usually treated?
Because it generally grows a bit slower and spreads later compared to the other type, treatment often includes surgery if possible, like taking out a lobe, lobectomy, or a whole lung pneumonectomy, plus radiation, chemo, or newer immunotherapies, more options generally.
Okay, so NSCLC gives some flexibility, but then there's the other one, SCLC. You said it's more aggressive.
Oh, considerably. Small cell lung cancer, SCLC, it's only about 13% of cases, but it's defined by how fast it grows rapid doubling time, and it's incredibly strong linked to smoking.
And the key thing for students to remember here,
SCLC is typically not surgical. That's crucial.
Why not?
Because it spreads so aggressively, often through the lymphatic system, and it frequently presents as systemic disease right from the start. By the time it's found, microscopic spread has usually already happened elsewhere, so just cutting out the main tumor doesn't work.
Ah, okay. So localized treatment isn't enough.
Right. Management is almost always about combination chemotherapy and high-dose radiation.
Right.
Plus, you need really intensive airway support because these tumors can grow so fast and block things off.
Okay, that's a huge difference. Let's shift gears to laryngeal cancer then. You called it the more preventable threat.
It often is, yes, though it still makes up about half of all head and neck cancers.
And the risk factors, similar to lung.
Very similar. Heavy tobacco use is number one, and that includes smoked products and smokeless tobacco, like chew.
Right.
Heavy chronic alcohol use is another big one. And when you combine tobacco and alcohol, the risk isn't just added, it's multiplied, exponentially higher.
Wow.
Definitely. We also see links to occupational exposures inhaling things like wood dust, paint fumes, asbestos. And like lung cancer, it's more common in older individuals and more common in men.
Okay. Now, students always see the TNM staging system mentioned for lots of cancers. How does that apply here? Tumor, node, metastasis. What does it tell the nurse, practically?
TNM is really the universal language of oncology staging. It helps you focus your assessment and understand the prognosis.
How so?
Well, T is for tumor size and extent. That tells you about the local problem, how much of the larynx or lung is directly involved.
Okay.
N is for node involvement, lymph nodes. If they're involved, it signals lymphatic spread, which increases the risk of the cancer traveling elsewhere.
Yeah, and M.
M is for metastasis. That's the big one. M1 means it has spread systemically to distant sites.
Mm.
And that usually shifts the treatment goal from cure to palliation, managing symptoms.
I see. And for laryngeal cancer specifically?
For laryngeal cancer, the early stages, like stage 1 and 2, meaning a small T, N0, no nodes, M0, no mets, they're often caught earlier because of voice changes. And they're generally much more treatable. The goal there is often organ preservation, trying to keep the patient's ability to speak and swallow.
But later stages?
Stages 3 and 4, with larger tumors or node involvement, often mean more drastic surgery is needed, potentially a total laryngectomy. So if we connect all the risks, the location, the staging to how patients actually present, recognizing those early signs is really the key to improving those survival numbers we talked about.
Right. What symptoms should a nurse be really watching for, and how do they differ between laryngeal and lung?
Okay, for laryngeal cancer, the big symptom, the one you really can't ignore, is hoarseness. Or any kind of sustained voice change.
Because the tumor is right there on the vocal cords.
Exactly. It forms on or near the cords, so the sound quality changes early on. The rule of thumb is any hoarseness lasting more than 2 weeks needs investigation, period.
Weeks.
Okay.
And advanced laryngeal cancer.
Then the symptoms become severe, even life-threatening. Things like really bad dysphagia, difficulty swallowing. You might even feel a lump, a neck mass. And critically, stridor, that high-pitched breathing sound, or other obvious signs that the airway is getting blocked by the tumor or swelling, that's an emergency.
Okay. And lung cancer, you said it's more sneaky.
Much more insidious, yeah. Often there are no symptoms at all until the late stages, until the tumor gets big enough to press on things or it spreads.
So those routine assessment questions are vital.
Absolutely. Asking about cough, shortness of breath, smoking history every time. Once symptoms do appear, the main one is usually a persistent cough or maybe a change in a chronic cough.
Change how?
Like someone has a regular smoker's cough, but suddenly it changes, it becomes productive when it wasn't, or it sounds deeper, or it hurts more. That change is a red flag. Needs looking into right away.
What other signs point towards lung cancer, maybe things that aren't directly respiratory?
Well, besides the obvious, like dyspnea, shortness of breath, or maybe hemoptysis, coughing up blood, you look for those constitutional symptoms. Unexplained weight loss, feeling profoundly tired all the time.
Okay.
Also, if the tumor is growing centrally, it can actually press on the nerve that controls the larynx, the recurrent laryngeal nerve. That can cause sudden hoarseness.
So hoarseness could be lung cancer or laryngeal cancer.
Exactly. But if it's from lung cancer, it usually means a potentially large mass pressing on that nerve. And chest pain or shoulder pain can suggest the cancer has spread to the pleura or the chest wall.
So for the learner, distinguishing a simple cough from something serious means connecting the symptom to the whole picture, especially the risk factors.
Precisely. That clinical judgment is key.
And we need to keep that metastasis watch going too, right? Lung cancer likes to travel. Where does it typically go?
Common sites besides the lymph nodes are the brain, bones, the adrenal glands, which sit on top of the kidneys, and the liver.
Which means our nursing assessment has to be broad.
Absolutely. Frequent neurochecks are important, asking about headaches, vision changes, checking balance or gait, asking about new deep bone pain, watching for signs of liver problems like jaundice or unexplained belly pain. It's all connected.
Okay, let's talk diagnostics. The tools used to confirm and stage these cancers, and especially that screening method nurses should really push for with high-risk folks.
Right. The standard tools are probably familiar. Chest x-ray is often the first step. Then CT scans, MRI, PE scans, which light up metabolically active areas like tumors. And then the definitive test is usually a bronchoscopy with a biopsy, getting a tissue sample.
Okay, but for prevention or early detection?
The key intervention, the public health piece nursing really champions, is low-dose CT screening, LDCT.
And who gets that? Not everyone.
No, it's specifically for high-risk adults. The criteria are pretty specific. People aged 55 to 80 who have a significant smoking history defined as a 30-pack year history or more, AE, who currently smoke or quit within the last 15 years.
30-pack years, age 55, 80, current or recent quitter.
That's the group.
And why is the nurse's role so vital in promoting LDCT?
Because patients often don't even know they qualify, or maybe they're scared of what might be found.
Yeah, I can see that.
So the nurse provides that essential education, explains who should get screened, clarifies that it's a low radiation scan, and crucially, emphasizes the benefit. LDCT has been proven to reduce lung cancer deaths in this high-risk group by 20%.
20%, that's significant.
It's huge. It's preventative oncology in action. Getting eligible patients into that screening process, helping them overcome fear or fatalism, making sure they follow through, that's a massive nursing contribution.
Okay, this is where it gets really hands-on, where theory hits the bedside hard. We're talking high stakes, fast action. Life and death situations often hinge on quick, skilled airway management. Let's start with a laryngeal obstruction emergency.
Right. This is one of those scenarios where speed is everything. Whether the obstruction is from a tumor, severe laryngitis, maybe an allergic reaction like anaphylaxis, you have to treat it as an immediate life-threatening crisis.
What's the core danger physiologically?
Rapid edema, swelling. The space in the larynx is incredibly tight. Just a few millimeters of swelling can slam the glottis shut. Leads to hypoxia, suffocation, fast. If you hear inspiratory stridor, that high-pitched noise when they breathe in, you're already playing catch-up.
So in that crisis moment, the nurse's thinking has to be intervene first, confirm later.
Absolutely. The diagnosis of acute laryngeal obstruction is primarily clinical. You see it. You assess the patient. Are they using accessory muscles to breathe? Are you seeing retractions in their neck or abdomen? Is their breathing paradoxical? Is their O2 sat dropping?
You don't wait for a scan.
You must not delay critical interventions to wait for diagnostic tests like a CT scan. If that airway is closing, you act now.
What does acting look like?
Emergency management means first, maintain or secure that airway. Position the patient upright high Fowler's. Get oxygen on them. Administer meds, things like nebulized epinephrine, which can constrict blood vessels and reduce swelling, and systemic corticosteroids, especially if it's allergy-related eczema.
I'd be ready for.
Be ready for an emergency tracheotomy or intubation. That means having the right equipment at the bedside, having the right team alerted and available immediately. The nurse is often the one orchestrating that immediate response.
Okay. That immediate crisis response often leads right into the next critical skill area, tracheostomy care. You said this is maybe the highest yield skill we can discuss.
I think it is. A trach isn't just for emergencies. It's indicated for bypassing an obstruction, yeah, but also for managing long-term respiratory failure, or when someone needs prolonged intubation, usually more than 14 days. A trach is often safer and much more comfortable long-term than an endotracheal tube down the throat.
What are the benefits for the patient?
Big ones. Improved comfort, definitely. They often need less sedation compared to being intubated. It allows for better oral hygiene, which reduces infection risk. And often, it allows for earlier communication, either verbally if possible or through other means, which is huge for their psychological well-being.
Okay, now managing that trach, there's a sterile technique mandate for suctioning. Non-negotiable, right?
Excellent.
Because you're going straight into the lower airway.
Absolutely non-negotiable. You're introducing a catheter deep into the sterile lower respiratory tract. Any break in technique risks introducing bacteria, leading to serious infections like VAP, ventilator-associated pneumonia, or infections at the stomacite itself.
Let's break down the three critical steps for safe suctioning. Every student needs to have this down cold.
Okay, three things. First, the procedure must be sterile. Gloves, catheter, everything.
Sterile. Got it.
Second, you only apply suction on the way out as you're withdrawing the catheter. And you use intermittent suction, not continuous. Why? To avoid literally stripping the delicate lining, the mucosa, off the trachea, which causes trauma and bleeding.
Only suction coming out. Intermittent. Okay, third.
Third, the total suctioning time for each pass must be 10 seconds or less. Short duration minimizes hypoxia. And crucially, you always pre-oxygenate the patient before you start. give him 100% oxygen for a minute or so.
Why pre-oxygenate?
Because the suctioning itself removes oxygen along with secretions. Pre-oxygenating builds up an oxygen reserve in the lungs to prevent their O2 sats from dropping dangerously low during the procedure. This whole sequence, sterile, suction out, 10 seconds, pre-oxygenate, it's a safety protocol you have to live by.
Makes sense. Nurses also deal a lot with managing secretions, right?
Right.
Trying to prevent those thick, nasty plugs that could block the tube.
Yeah, that's a constant focus. The best approach is usually encouraging hydration. Keeping the patient well hydrated helps thin out the secretions naturally, making them easier to suction or cough up.
Unless,
and this is where clinical judgment is critical, unless the patient has a contraindication like severe congestive heart failure, CHF, or renal failure. In those cases, pushing fluids could actually be dangerous. It could overload their system and cause pulmonary edema fluid backing up into the lungs. That creates a whole new respiratory emergency. So you always check for those comorbidities.
Good point. What else helps with secretions?
Humidification is key. Adding moisture to the air they breathe through the trach prevents secretions from drying out, getting crusty. Dry, crusty secretions can irritate the airway, cause bleeding, and form those dangerous plugs. So a humidifier on the trach collar is standard.
Okay, let's talk safety equipment. Everyone learns, keep two extra trach tubes at the bedside. But what's the common mistake in an emergency, like if the trach accidentally comes out?
That's a great clinical question because protocols are one thing, emergencies are another. Under pressure, the biggest mistake is often trying to force the same size tube back in too quickly, maybe at the wrong angle, without really seeing where it's going.
And what happens then?
You can easily create a false passage. Shove the tube into the subcutaneous tissue next to the trachea instead of in it. The patient looks like they have a trach in, but they're still not getting air. They're suffocating.
Scary.
Very. That's why the safety critical check is so specific. Keep the current size trach tube A&D one size smaller at the bedside, readily accessible in an emergency kit.
Why one size smaller?
Because if the stoma has started to swell or contract even slightly after the tube came out, or if you're having trouble getting the original size back in, that smaller tube might be the only thing that slips in easily and reestablishes the airway quickly before things close up completely.
Yeah.
Knowing where that kit is, checking it every shift, that's fundamental safety.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
What are the main complications nurses need to be constantly monitoring for with trach patients?
It's ongoing vigilance. Immediately post-insertion, you worry about pneumothorax, a collapsed lung, which can happen if the pleura is nicked during insertion or sometimes from overly aggressive suctioning.
Okay.
Significant bleeding from the site. Infection redness, pus, swelling around the stoma. Aspiration is a big one, too, because the trach can sometimes interfere with the normal swallowing mechanism.
Long-term,
the main concern is often tracheal stenosis. That's a narrowing of the trachea, usually caused by prolonged pressure from the trach cuff inflating against the tracheal wall. So proper cuff pressure management is vital. And you're always assessing respiratory effort, vital signs, listening to breath sounds, checking the stoma itself, any new subcutaneous emphysema, that crackly feeling under the skin around the neck called crepitus, needs immediate attention to.
So after the initial surgery or treatment, the focus really shifts, doesn't it? It becomes incredibly personalized. The nurse's role transitions from that acute critical care to really intensive support psychologically, functionally, communicatively.
Right. Let's talk about the surgical options for laryngeal cancer first, because the choice made there drastically changes the patient's life afterward.
Absolutely. The goal is always cure, if possible, while maximizing function. So sometimes a partial laryngectomy is possible. That means removing only part of the larynx. The aim there is to preserve the voice and swallowing as much as possible.
But sometimes that's not an option. Right. The alternative is a total laryngectomy. That's the complete removal of the larynx, the voice box. And this fundamentally changes the anatomy. It permanently separates the airway from the digestive tract.
Meaning
the patient will breathe through a permanent opening in their neck, called a tracheostoma, and they will have a complete permanent loss of their natural voice. That's a huge thing to grasp.
Huge. And for lung cancer surgery?
It varies. Could be a lobectomy, removing just one lobe of the lung, or a pneumonectomy, removing an entire lung. But increasingly, especially for more advanced cases or for small cell lung cancer, the management is non-surgical. Chemotherapy, radiation, or those newer immunotherapies like checkpoint inhibitors.
Okay, let's go back to the total laryngectomy, the loss of voice. That's profound.
Yeah.
How does the nurse help with communication rehabilitation? What are the options?
This is a massive part of nursing care. There are basically three main ways patients can learn to communicate again.
Okay, what's the first?
First is esophageal speech. This takes a lot of practice, intense training with a speech therapist. The patient basically learns to swallow air into their esophagus, then bring it back up in a controlled way, kind of like a controlled burp.
Right.
That released air vibrates the top part of the esophagus, the pharyngoesophageal segment, creating a rough, low-pitched sound that they shape into words with their mouth. It's hard to master and usually only allows for short phrases.
Basically called, what's the second option?
Yeah.
Something mechanical.
Yes, the artificial larynx or electric larynx. It's a handheld battery-powered device. The patient holds it against their neck or sometimes their cheek.
And it makes a noise.
It produces a vibration when turned on. The patient then uses their tongue, lips, and mouth to shape that vibration into speech sounds. It's much easier and quicker to learn than esophageal speech, so it provides immediate communication. But the downside is the voice quality. It often sounds robotic or monotonic.
Okay. And the third method, you mentioned it often sounds the most natural.
That's the tracheoesophageal puncture, or TIP. Often uses something called the Bloom-Singer valve. This involves a small surgical puncture, a channel made between the trachea and the esophagus.
What?
A little one-way valve, a prosthesis, is placed in that channel. To speak, the patient covers their stoma, the neck opening with their finger.
Why cover the stoma?
Covering the stoma redirects the air they're exhaling from their lungs. Instead of going out the neck, the air goes through that little valve into the esophagus. This vibrates the tissue, creating sound. Because it uses lung air, like natural speech, it allows for longer, clearer, more fluent sentences. Sounds much more natural.
But it requires...
It absolutely requires dedicated speech therapy to learn how to use it effectively, and it requires meticulous care of the stoma and the valve itself by the patient with nursing support. Cleaning the valve is crucial.
Given how life-altering this is, the preoperative nursing focus must be huge. You can't just spring this on someone after surgery.
Absolutely not. Pre-op education is paramount. It's not just about explaining the surgery, it's intense psychological preparation. The nurse has to clearly explain the mechanics of losing the voice, what the equipment will look like, the G-tube they might need initially for feeding, the tract tube or stoma care, explain that permanent separation of breathing and swallowing.
And the most critical piece, pre-op.
The most critical piece is establishing alternative communication methods before surgery. Cannot stress this enough. Have writing boards ready. Maybe an electronic device, like a tablet with a communication app. Picture boards, even. Imagine waking up from major surgery, possibly in pain, and having no way to tell anyone what you need. It's terrifying and hinders recovery. So setting up that communication plan beforehand is vital.
Absolutely. Okay, moving into holistic postoperative care. What are the immediate complications nurses are watching for right after surgery?
Post-op monitoring is intense. Top of the list is respiratory distress, obviously, but also hemorrhage bleeding. Any sudden gush of bright red blood or drainage consistently over, say, 100 milliliter per hour for a couple of hours, that's an emergency. Call the surgeon immediately.
What else?
We're watching the wound for signs of breakdown or infection. We're vigilant for aspiration, especially as they start trying to manage secretions or eventually swallow. And monitoring for tracheostomal stenosis, that narrowing of the opening.
And general care.
General care is comprehensive. Good pain management is key. Can't let pain stop them from breathing deeply or participating in care. Nutritional support, often starting with the G-tube, until a swallow evaluation says it's safe to try eating. Huge psychological and mental health support dealing with body image changes, the loss of voice, the cancer diagnosis itself.
Plus airway stuff.
Always. Airway clearance through careful suctioning as needed. Teaching breathing exercises. Helping with energy conservation because fatigue after these surgeries and treatments is profound. Managing that fatigue is a big nursing role.
You mentioned earlier that many of these patients are older adults. What special considerations does that bring?
That's a really important point. Statistically, yes, most patients with these cancers are over 65. They often come to the table with multiple other health problems, comorbidities like COPD, heart disease, diabetes.
And that affects treatment?
Heavily. The nurse has to recognize that these other conditions, plus the patient's overall physical function before the cancer, drastically influence whether they're even a candidate for major surgery, how chemo or radiation doses might need adjustment, and what their recovery might look like. Treatment goals might shift more towards quality of life and maintaining independence rather than just aggressive cure at all costs. It requires really nuanced, individualized care planning.
Okay, let's switch focus slightly to the procedures nurses are directly involved with, either at the bedside or prepping the patient. For you, the learner, we need to nail down the key nursing actions before and after the doctor does their part.
Mm.
Let's talk about the big three endoscopies.
Right. Good plan. Let's start with bronchoscopy. This is where they use a scope, usually flexible but sometimes rigid, to directly look inside the larynx, trachea, and bronchi. Essential for diagnosis, taking biopsies, staging, sometimes even for therapy, like clearing out thick mucus plugs or stopping bleeding.
So what does the nurse need to do beforehand? What are the absolute must-dos?
Pre-procedure safety is paramount. The patient absolutely must be NPO, nothing by mouth, for 4 to 8 hours before the procedure.
Why NPO?
To minimize the risk of aspiration, if there's food or liquid in the stomach and the patient gags or sedated reflexes are dulled, they could inhale that stomach content into their lungs. That's a disaster.
Yeah.
So empty stomach is key.
Okay, NPO 4 to 8 hours. What else?
Nurse verifies the consent form is signed. Make sure any dentures or oral prosthetics are removed. Administers pre-op meds as ordered, often something like atropine to dry secretions and prevent the heart rate from dropping due to vagal stimulation, plus a sedative like midazolam for anxiety.
And post-procedure, what are we watching for?
Post-procedure, the main concern is the return of protective airway reflexes, specifically the gag reflex. You monitor closely for complications. Pneumothorax, collapsed lung, hypoxemia, low oxygen, laryngospasm, spasm of the vocal cords, and bleeding. And critically important, do not allow the patient to eat or drink anything until their gag reflex has fully returned. Test it gently with a swab. If they gag, they can likely protect their airway. Until then, NPO continues.
Got it. No food or drink until gag reflex returns. Next up, thoracoscopy, often called VATS.
Right. Video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery. It's much less invasive than a big open chest surgery. They use small incisions and an endoscope with a camera to look inside the pleural cavity, that space between the lung and the chest wall.
What's it used for?
Lots of things. Diagnosing pleural effusions, fluid buildup, treating them sometimes, staging tumors by looking directly at the pleura, getting lung biopsies, especially from the outer parts of the lung.
And nursing care after VATS.
Meticulous monitoring again. Vitals, pain control, it's still surgery. Respiratory status rate, effort, breath sounds, O2 sats, checking the small incision sites. The absolute critical danger sign to watch for and report immediately is any new or worsening shortness of breath.
Why is that so critical?
Because it's the cardinal sign of a potential post-procedural pneumothorax, a collapsed lung. Needs immediate assessment and intervention.
Okay. Sometimes they place a chest tube after VATS. Right. What do students need to know about monitoring that? How do you tell normal drainage from a problem?
Yes. Chest tubes are common after VATS.
Mm-hmm.
Monitoring that drainage is key. You track the amount and the character. Initially, it might be a bit bloody, but it should gradually decrease in volume and turn more serosanguineous, kind of pinkish or straw colored.
And the danger sign?
The danger sign is a sudden increase in drainage, especially if it's bright red, frank blood. If you see output greater than, say, 100 millimeter per hour for 2 consecutive hours, that suggests active bleeding, a surgical emergency. Notify the physician immediately. You're also making sure the whole chest tube system is working right, maintaining suction if ordered, checking for air leaks, ensuring the water seal chamber is titling, fluctuating with breathing properly.
Okay. Third major procedure, thoracentesis.
Right. This is usually done at the bedside. It's aspirating fluid or sometimes air from that pleural space using a needle.
Why do it?
Two main reasons. Diagnostic. You send the fluid off to the lab, look for cancer cells, cytology, check for infection, culture, analyze protein levels, etc. Or therapeutic. If there's a large amount of fluid or air compressing the lung and making it hard to breathe, you drain it off to provide relief.
And the nurse's role during and after?
Nursing involves positioning the patient correctly, often sitting upright, leaning forward over a bedside table. This helps spread the ribs and makes access easier. Ensuring the patient stays still during the needle insertion is crucial. Afterward, you monitor very closely for complications, primarily pneumothorax again if the lung gets accidentally nicked by the needle. Watch for sudden shortness of breath, sharp chest pain, rapid shallow breathing, maybe a drop in O2 sats. Also monitor the puncture site for bleeding or leakage.
Okay, let's wrap this section with a couple of critical thinking scenarios.
Yeah.
Really cement the bedside assessment priorities, connecting procedures and meds.
Good idea. Scenario one, you've got a post-op patient, maybe after lung surgery, and they're on continuous opioid pain medication, IV morphine, hydromorphone, maybe a PCA pump. What's the absolute priority for monitoring?
Respiratory depression.
Exactly. But what are the early signs? It's not just waiting for the O2 sat to drop. The earliest signs are a decreased respiratory rate and decreased respiratory depth. shallow breathing, and increasing sedation.
So you need a sedation scale.
You absolutely need to use a validated sedation scale, like the RFS Richmond Agitation Sedation Scale. Don't just rely on the pulse oximeter. If your patient is becoming increasingly difficult to arouse, if their ARAS mid of 3 or mid of 4, deep sleep, responds only to physical stim, their respiratory drive is already significantly depressed. You need to intervene, then stop the opioid, stimulate them verbally and physically, maybe administer naloxone if needed, call for help long before the SpO2 plummets.
Catch it early with rate, depth, and sedation level.
Got it. Okay, scenario 2. Patient with known laryngeal cancer, maybe a few days after finishing radiation therapy, they suddenly develop acute shortness of breath and a new productive cough. What's your immediate priority, your action sequence? Priority 1, immediate focused respiratory assessment. Get them positioned upright, high Fowler's if possible. Apply supplemental oxygen right away. Then start rapid data gathering. What's the respiratory rate? What's the effort look like? Are they using accessory muscles? What do the breath sounds reveal? Crackles, raunchy, wheezes, diminished sounds. Check the O2 set. And importantly, look closely at that sputum. What's the color, consistency, amount?
What are you trying to figure out quickly?
You're trying to rapidly differentiate potential causes. Is this an infection like pneumonia? Did they aspirate something? Is it perhaps radiation pneumonitis and inflammation from the treatment? Or is it worsening edema related to the tumor or treatment? You're gathering those key data points in seconds to decide. Do I need to call a rapid response? Do I need to prepare for more aggressive airway management? That initial precise assessment determines the next steps and can save their life. #, outro.
So after covering all of that, what's the big takeaway? We've hit major cancers, complex procedures, and really drilled down on those critical nursing actions needed to keep patients safe, from setting up communication before surgery to mastering that emergency track care.
Yeah, I think for you, the learner, the core action items, the things to really master are pretty clear now.
Yeah.
Definitely know the exact steps and safety rules for sterile tracheostomy care. That pre-oxygenation, the 10-second limit, suctioning on the way out, having those two tubes ready, that's non-negotiable.
Right.
Understand what the T&M staging actually means for the patient's prognosis and likely treatment path. Be ready to educate patients and families about those different communication methods after a total laryngectomy, tet-tet, artificial larynx, esophageal speech, and support them through that huge adjustment.
Recognizing trouble.
And yes, mastering the recognition of those subtle early signs of potentially lethal complications, especially pneumothorax, that sudden shortness of breath, and also VTE blood clots, DVT or PE, which are always a risk after major surgery or with cancer itself.
It really highlights something profound, doesn't it? All the technology, the specialized oncology teams, they treat the disease. But day in, day out, minute by minute, the nurse is the frontline safeguard.
Absolutely.
Guarding the patient's airway, their ability to communicate, their basic comfort and safety, their overall quality of life.
That's the essence of it.
And maybe the final thought, the real challenge for you out there listening, isn't just memorizing the name of a complication like pneumothorax. It's developing the assessment skill to know when to pick up the phone, when to escalate, when to call for help immediately based on what you see and hear. That split-second decision, it rests entirely on your eyes, your ears, your hands, your clinical judgment. Detecting that first tiny change in breathing effort, sometimes that's the only warning you get before things go critical.